It is so fabulous to have Minneapolis chef and James Beard award-winning food writer Beth Dooley back on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Beth has been cooking and writing about local food for more than four decades. She's the author or co-author of more than a dozen cookbooks, and she's on this journey to better understand how food is grown, where it comes from, and the ripple effect it has on flavor, on our health, on the environment. What do you want to ask Beth about cooking? Do you love one of her recipes or cookbooks? Tell us about it, 800-642-1234. Beth Dooley's new one is called The Perennial Kitchen, Simple Recipes for a Healthy Future. Beth, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Oh, Kate, it's so fun to be with you. Thanks for having me back. What a beautiful morning.
It is. And I'm thinking about the definition of perennial, lasting or existing for a long or apparently infinite time. I'm also seeing my lovely perennials in my yard. And I'm wondering, what does that word mean to you in the kitchen?
That's a great question. It resonates a lot with me, both personally and for the implications on our farms. It means beautiful food that comes back year after year and improves the land, improves our lives, doesn't require a lot of toxins or herbicides. It's not an annual like our corn and soy crops that are ripped up every year and replanted and have all kinds of serious implications for the environment. Instead, these are crops that nurture us and then also nurture our pollinators and our songbirds, and they filter water and they keep topsoil from running into the land. So perennial crops are really important, and so is keeping cover on the land, continuous cover on the land, and many of those crops produce food as well. So it's paying attention not only to flavor, which is where my journey always starts, is flavor. Why does something taste different than something else? But then understanding that flavor is determined by how and where a food is grown, and then understanding the implications of that, not just for our kitchens, but for our landscape, for our farmers, for our rural communities, and for our urban communities as well.
And you're really talking here about regenerative agriculture practices.
Yes.
As you give these examples, you know, as a consumer, how do you know a product or produce is coming through the regenerative agriculture model, if you will?
That's a great question. And there is a lot of confusion around that. Many of us talk about sustainability, which is terrific. I mean, we want to look for crops that are sustainable, but it's really a matter of terminology. Sustainability suggests staying the same, right? Mm. Regenerative means improvement. So what we're talking about is extending the whole sort of value system around local food to embrace larger crops like wheat, and many of the grains that are now being grown out, many, they're called artisan grains, but we're talking about oats and barley, rye, that can keep continuous cover on the land. And then also looking at the value of animals on the land as well. So cattle, for instance, and both dairy and beef cattle, hogs, geese, ducks, chickens, animals that are out on pasture, because pasture is not only a wonderful way to capture water and to keep topsoil on the land, but also drives carbon back into the ground, which is a wonderful way to mitigate climate change. So it speaks to the larger issues of our food system, as well as the need for more flavorful, more nutritious food. So it embraces, it's a larger sort of embrace of the notion of sustainability, or simply local food, to encompass large farms as well.
Yeah, and really looking at these farms as, you know, how, you know, approaching the land as a whole ecosystem, if you will.
Correct.
And working with it with a holistic approach.
That's exactly right. And as much as we want to call this new, it's not new at all. These are practices that are embedded in all of the indigenous cultures around the world. For instance, the American Indian movement is really, really returning to this. And a lot of the tribes are returning to this. It's understanding, too, what grows best in certain areas and then managing it in a way that ensures it comes back every year, or planting it in ways where different plants nurture each other. Think, for instance, of Three Sisters, right, where it's corn you know, squash and beans, for instance, that grow so beautifully together because those crops nourish each other. So it's looking at how our, as you said, it's looking at ecosystems and then replicating what those ecosystems are on a larger scale so we can grow more, more of those crops without damaging anything.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with cookbook author Beth Dooley, our guide to cooking with fresh ingredients, supporting local farms. Have you found yourself cooking more in the pandemic? What have you been trying? Maybe it's an heirloom recipe passed down in your family. Are you trying to cook healthier meals at home? What advice would you like to get from Beth on this front? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Beth, you've been writing about local food for the better part of four decades. Are you still discovering? Is there more to learn?
I am, and that's what got me interested in all of this. I mean, I started out, you know, as a young cook, just loving the farmers markets and what I could find there, and then joining a CSA and really diving into cooking with whatever was coming out of the you know, the farms at the time, and learning to be actually a more reactive cook rather than marching into the supermarket with a list of what I wanted to purchase to make a particular soup or a pesto or something. And then just looking at what I had and then creating meals from that. So it was a much different way of thinking about recipes and thinking about what I was going to cook. And it just made me curious to know, well, what else is there? What else is happening locally? And I got really interested in wheat, for example, because it's just this iconic, I mean, wheat has so many great stories around it. It's one of those crops that kind of founded our whole region, founded the economy, founded our, you know, it provided all kinds of opportunities for the early settlers. It also had implications for moving indigenous people off their farms. And so what does that mean? And I started to look at what our modern wheat does to our environment. I just got curious about that. And then I discovered the work being done by the Forever Green Initiative at the University of Minnesota, as well as the Land Institute down in Kansas. Salina, Kansas, yeah, to begin perennializing wheat as a crop, because wheat's a grass, so it can be grown as a grass. And then I got interested in kernza, which is a hybrid. It's called an intermediate wheat grass, and looking at what that could mean, not only for me as a baker, as a cook, what's that grain like? What does it taste like? What do you do with it? What
How
happens
does it
to
taste?
The flour?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's just sort of following my curiosity. I mean, I guess I go stumbling into these things because I'm so curious about them. And I think once you become curious about different foods, it guides you into understanding nature, science, history. I mean, it's just, for me, it's a window into understanding our world. And I just find it endlessly fascinating. So.
Well, on the topic of kernza, the Land Institute and the University of Minnesota have been working to bring this perennial grain to a wider audience, if you will. How does kernza have the potential to change how farmers grow crops?
It's a great question. Because it's a perennial grain, it comes back every year, and it has several uses. When it comes up early in the spring, animals can forage it, and just like our lawns, it will come back and then produce a seed head, which is a grain, and that can be harvested and then threshed and then milled into flour, which is a really interesting flour. It behaves like wheat, but it has a different gluten structure. So it can be used in yeasted breads, but it will make a denser bread, more like a rye bread. But it makes a wonderful pound cake or cookies or pancakes. And then the grain itself can be simmered and put into a pilaf or soup. Behaves like any sort of wheat berry or any kind of other grain. It's delicious. And so it has a lot of value, not only in the kitchen, but also to the land, because its taproot goes down about 20 feet. So it does all kinds of wonderful things for the land and for us.
Cookbook author Beth Dooley sharing her favorite recipes, her approach to her latest cooking. It's called The Perennial Kitchen. Are you trying to cook healthier foods at home with local ingredients? What advice would you like to get from Beth in the kitchen? Have you struggled to bring some recipes to fruition? Let's talk about it. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Beth Dooley on the Ideas Network. What a pleasure to talk with cookbook author Beth Dooley on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. She writes in her new cookbook, "What matters to me is the hands-on craft of making a meal with ingredients that come from familiar places and have been grown by people who care as much as I do about our planet." We're learning from Beth about dishes that nourish us, help our environment. Do you use fresh ingredients from your garden or from a local farm? What are your favorite ones to use? Do you consider your pantry a perennial pantry? Join in 800-642-1234. Beth Dooley's latest cookbook is called The Perennial Kitchen, and she's with us for the hour. Beth, what can you stock in your pantry to make it that perennial kitchen pantry?
That's a great question. Thank you for answering. Lots of grains. We grow a number of different grains in our region. We're really the breadbasket of the world, or we were known as the breadbasket of the world. So barley, wheat, rye, kernza, oats, millet, for instance, are all wonderful grains to have at hand. And I like using them better than pasta, for instance, which is, you know, milled and doesn't have a lot of nutrients. And much of the pasta is imported in from different areas. Then I also love some of our local nuts. Hazelnuts are fabulous. And, you know, Wisconsin grows a lot of hazelnuts, mm-hmm. thanks to the work being done by the American Hazelnut Company, which is based down in Gay Mill, Wisconsin, outside Madison. But they process their nuts up in Ashland at the Northland College Food Processing Center. And they're beautiful nuts, and they're so good. They're tinier than the nuts that come in from Oregon or from Turkey. They're toasted before they're sold, so they're nice and crunchy, and you don't have to do anything to them. You just use them. You don't have to roast them the way you do the larger nuts to get that bitter peel off. And then they have a fabulous hazelnut oil.
Yeah.
I love that oil. It's so tasty, and I use it for salads, okay. and I also use it for stir frying because it has a higher smoke point than does olive oil, and because it's virgin pressed, it has all of the nutrients that olive oil has in it. So it's a really heart-healthy oil, but it's more versatile than olive oil, for example. And then what I really love is the American Hazelnut Company mills the what's left over from pressing those nuts into oil and sells that as a gluten-free flour, hazelnut flour. So, it's this wonderful plant that produces three foods and also is terrific forage for animals. Chickens love to roost underneath hazelnut trees, and they like to eat the nuts. Mm. And then, you can use the wood for biodiesel or to make small furniture. I mean, it's just got all of these uses. It's a terrific, terrific plant.
Well, I picked up hazelnut flour in anticipation of our conversation.
Oh, yay! Oh, that's great.
And yeah, it was such a happy accident because yesterday I ran out of all-purpose flour for the waffles. And so I added, I made up for it with like a fourth a cup of hazelnut flour. So not much, but just a little bit in there to just a standard waffle recipe. And oh my goodness, it was like subtly so good. It really worked out well.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that. That's great. That's great. I'm so glad you did that. Good girl. That's great.
Well, and you also have a hazelnut parmesan crisp recipe. And we have it, by the way, at WPR.org/mornings. And honestly, that is what I picked up the flour for to make those crisps. And they turned out it was neat. My daughter looked over my shoulder and she's like, "Mom, that disc seems really hard. What are you doing with that?" I'm like, "You know what? Beth has got us. She's got us. We just got to go with it here."
Oh, I'm so glad. Well, you know, one of the reasons why we have so many crackers in the baking section of the book is because that's a great way to taste some of these grains that may be unfamiliar to people and to taste some of these flours. They're so easy to make. Crackers are easier to make than cookies, actually. And I just want people to taste the different nuances. We don't think of flours as having flavor, right?
Yeah.
But the flours of these different grains really do have their own distinct flavors, and they're fun to play with. So I'm so glad you did that. And that was sort of the idea behind the book, is some of these crops, even though they're old crops, are unfamiliar to a modern cook. So how do we bring them back into the kitchen just the way we want our farmers to bring them back onto the land?
We're talking with cookbook author Beth Dooley, and as we look at healthy farm ingredients, flours, baking, her most recent cookbook is called The Perennial Kitchen. You can join in. What questions do you have about cooking? What would you like to know? Have you done any fruit picking this season? What recipes have you made so far with your fresh ingredients? 800-642-1234. So Beth, you know, let's walk through your hazelnut Parmesan crisp. I was able to luckily use thyme from my garden, which was great.
Oh, fun.
Yeah. You know, explain what goes in here.
It's super easy. There are just a couple of ingredients. It's the hazelnut flour, and then a little bit of Parmesan cheese, grated Parmesan cheese, a couple of egg whites, some fresh thyme, but you could use almost any chopped herb. You could use fresh parsley, or you could use oregano or rosemary, or marjoram, whatever you happen to have and like. You could also use dried if you wanted to. You'd cut back on the amount if you were going to use dried. And then a little bit of salt and a pinch of red pepper flakes just to give it some heat. And that's really it. Mm. And what's fun for me, I don't know if you did this, and is once you pat that disc out on top of the baking sheet, you know, you make a dough and you pat this disc out, and then you need to roll it so that it's thin. If you put a sheet of parchment paper over that disc and then take the hazelnut oil bottle, which is the perfect size for most baking sheets, it fits right inside the baking sheet. That can be your rolling pin. And that's what I usually do, because most rolling pins are too fat to put on a baking sheet. So that's a trick that I like to use. Yeah.
And then you just, you know, bake that low and slow for about a half hour. And you have these crispy kind of crackers that are pretty versatile. I know I dip mine in hummus. I thought that was really good. I
know. That sounds delicious. Well, that gets to another crop that's really good for the land, and that's the dried beans. And you can make hummus out of almost any dried beans. So if you happen to have white beans or kidney beans, or, I mean, we always think of hummus as being, you know, made with chickpeas, but you can certainly make it with just about any bean. And our growers are growing a lot of beans. And beans are great because they're a nitrogen fixer. So they'll return nutrients to the soil, whether you're a gardener or whether you're, you know, whether you're buying them at the farmer's market. And at the end of the summer, if you happen to, you know, happen upon fresh dried beans, which sounds like an oxymoron, buy them. They're so good.
How do you soften your beans? How do you cook them down?
You know, I know that it's great to simply soak them overnight, which is probably, I usually get the best results when I do that. Soak them in water to cover by about 2 inches in a bowl overnight, and then drain them and cook them in another pot of water with enough water to cover the beans by about 4 inches. Some fresh herbs and maybe some, garlic or chopped onion or something to give them some flavor. People always advise against salting the beans in the cooking water, but I've never had a trouble with that. I've always added a little bit of salt the way you do pasta, because then it's absorbed by the beans. The other trick is to cover the beans with hot water and let them sit for about an hour or so. They'll plump right up and then cook them. But to be honest, if you're buying your dried beans at the farmer's market or at the co-op, typically they're fresher dried beans than you'd find in one of those bags on the supermarket shelves. And if they're local, they might have been, you know, relatively freshly dried. And it just means if I forget to soak them, I'll throw them in a pot and just cook them until they open. And they may take a little longer to cook than if they've been pre-soaked, but they turn out just fine. So don't think that you can't make something with dried beans because you've forgotten to soak them. Just remember, you're going to have to cook them a little bit longer. And it's really by the type of bean and your preference for how well cooked you'd like it.
How firm you want it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You mentioned pasta noodles, and I'm wondering, when you cook grains, for instance, what is your approach to cooking grains? Because that sometimes can be a little bit tricky, because you don't want that mushy effect either.
Yeah, you don't want them overcooked. Basically, it's to pay attention. Some of the grains, like rye, for instance, or wheat berries, especially spring wheat berries, are a little harder, and they take longer to cook. And those are okay if you want to pre-soak those. Go ahead and do that. Maybe soak them the night before, then drain them and cook them. And if you do that, they'll cook in about 15 minutes, maybe, just like pasta, right? Mm-hmm. But you want to, again, keep an eye on them. You want to cook them until they open. If you're working with naturally harvested wild rice, that cooks really quickly. I love that grain because that will cook within about 15 minutes. And then you drain it and use it in a pilaf or a soup or in a bowl with a really yummy dressing.
Keep it in the refrigerator. Yeah.
So versatile. Yeah. And to me, those are really easier to work with than pasta because they store beautifully. They don't get gummy the way pasta does or slimy the way pasta does if you cook it in advance. So you can hold these things in the refrigerator in a covered bowl or a jar, and you've got a grain ready to go for whatever you want to make.
Cookbook author Beth Dooley sharing her way of cooking, and we'll be back with her after a news update on the ideas. It is such a pleasure to spend the hour with cookbook author Beth Dooley on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. So Beth has been writing and cooking for more than four decades. Her latest cookbook is called The Perennial Kitchen, and she writes that cooking is simple, it's powerful, yet it needn't be overwhelming. Often the best meals are inspired by what is already in the pantry, the garden, the farmer's market. The sum of our daily choices will ultimately impact our collective future. Have you experimented with a recipe or have a family recipe you've been working on in the pandemic? What questions do you have about cooking, about baking for Beth? 800-642-1234 to join in. Beth, let's go to another recipe. This one, polenta and fried eggs. Again, we have this at WPR.org/mornings to find the recipe. So polenta, you know, I think of it as yellow cornmeal. What are you doing with polenta?
I love polenta. It's got so many uses and just a wonderful flavor. It has, especially if you're using a local polenta that's relatively freshly ground, you can really taste the corn in it. And most people think of polenta for breakfast, but I like taking the polenta you've made for dinner and warming it up and then putting an egg on it for a brunch and maybe serving it with some asparagus on the side. You can also use polenta in cornbread and in your pancake recipe or in crepes. I mean, it's a wonderful, wonderful flour. Not really a flour, but I mean, I use polenta as a coarser grind of the dried corn, the flint corn. Mm-hmm. But it's really versatile. It's really delicious. There's also corn flour, which is milled to be a little, you know, finer and fluffier. And that is a great, you know, you can also use that in tortillas and in cornbread, for instance. And then there's masa, which is ground from corn that's been soaked. It's a hominy, really, that's been soaked in alkaline and then dried again and ground into flour. And that's why that's moisture. And that's what's used to make those beautiful masa tortillas, those flatbreads. Yeah, so good. Yeah. Yeah. So there's all kinds of uses for it. And I just think we limit it to what we're going to have for dinner, but it's wonderful for breakfast as well. It's delicious if you just put some maple syrup on it too.
Is it true that the finer the grain used to make the polenta, the creamier your ultimate product will be?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Because if it's coarser, it's going to be a little nuttier, a little chewier. Uh-huh. And then the finer grind is going to be a little creamier, a little smoother. And then, you know, it goes down from there. So it's just a matter of your preference, really, more than anything else. And I think that's what's so fun about using all of these foods in different ways is when they're grown well, they have such terrific flavors. And then you just mess around with them. you know, and I mean, don't get limited. Think about the flavor. For instance, most people think of rhubarb as being, and we've got so much rhubarb coming up right now.
Oh,
and
my
most
goodness.
People, I know, it's great, right? And that's a perennial, and it comes back on its own, and it's delicious. And we always think of it just as for pie or jams or, you know, sauces and things, but it's a wonderful savory, too. It's actually a vegetable. And it's great if you, what I like to do is stew it and then strain it so you get a rhubarb sort of juice, which is pretty tart. And mm-hmm. you can whisk that into a vinaigrette with hazelnut oil and a little mustard maybe and just a dab of honey, and you have a really nice vinaigrette for an asparagus salad. So there are things like that that you can do with rhubarb that people often, you know, think, oh, rhubarb's just for dessert. Well, no, it's for lots of things.
Well, you did mention dessert. I love strawberry rhubarb crisp.
Yeah.
And I just had, it was so amazing with that fresh rhubarb. I mean, it is great. You can also, I've also tried strawberry rhubarb jelly. That works well too.
Yeah. Oh, it's great. It's just great. It's so versatile. And when you mix it with strawberries, of course, you get that nice balance of the tartness with the sweetness. And that's part of what playing with these flavors is about, is looking for balance on the plate.
One of our listeners shared over email that they love baking bread with buckwheat flour. They use no more than 10% buckwheat flour in dough. They also add a touch of maple syrup and wants to know how that sounds.
Sounds fabulous. Are you kidding? Keep doing it. Buckwheat's a wonderful grain. It's gluten-free. And, you know, of course, it's big in Brittany, France, where they make those crepes. They call them, I can't remember the name in French. But it's typical of the Briton cuisine. And they're savory. So buckwheat has a nice, almost bitter edge to it, which works beautifully with bread. I'm glad she's only adding a quarter of a cup because it would interrupt the rise if you were just to make something just with buckwheat, because it's gluten that makes things rise. So when you mix it with flour, you still get the rise, but it gives that extra flavor. And then you have a nice balance with maple, and that's completely regional. I mean, you're really cooking from our region when you do things like that. So that sounds, I want that recipe. It sounds great.
And you really do love cooking with maple syrup as well, because of that local connection.
Exactly. And it has such a nice flavor that I find that I use less of it than if I'm using processed sugar, because it does add an extra flavor to whatever it is I'm making. So you can cut back a little bit. Still has sweetness, but it also adds another dimension of flavor, a little smokiness, maybe that woodsy note, and you can taste it in whatever you're making.
We're talking with cookbook author Beth Dooley, teaching us how to stock up our pantry and think of perennial ingredients, farm fresh ingredients, more holistic way of cooking. You can join in with questions that you have about baking, about breads, about maybe that next summer barbecue that you want a new dish to bring to. Join in. Inspiration here, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So Beth, if you are going to that 4th of July picnic, or you want to bring a new dish to a summer gathering with family, do you have any ideas for us that might be something that might be out of our normal thing that we might bring?
It's a great question. Thank you. I would bring a great big wild rice or mixed grain salad for starts, because you can make it ahead. You can boil those grains ahead and then just drain them and keep them in the fridge until you're ready to dress them with a nice light vinaigrette and throw into them any of the fresh vegetables that are in season. Then, which at that time of the year, we would probably have peas, for instance, maybe some green beans. It'd be great to have green beans. I don't think we'll have corn quite yet, but if we do, you could throw some of that in. We could add some chopped carrots, some baby carrots, and then maybe throw some garlic into the vinaigrette, lots of fresh herbs. Tomatoes might be in by then, certainly some of the smaller cherry tomatoes that might be early, or if you have, if you go to the farmer's market, many of our growers are using hoop houses to get a jump on the season, chop up some tomatoes and throw them in. It would be bright and pretty. It will hold well, so you can make all of this ahead, keep it in the fridge, and just bring it in a covered dish. I mean, I think that's what I would bring, because it's so easy, right? And portable. That's the other thing. Again, I love things that you can make ahead and bring.
What do you do with your dressings? Because, you know, certainly there, I love to throw in whatever is looking really good in the garden with my herbs, and whether it's, you know, parsley, oregano, some thyme in there. But with your garlic, how do you do your garlic in your dressing?
Another great question. I just throw it in. I smash it up. And the same thing with shallots. You could do that with shallots.
Okay.
Let them soften a little bit in vinegar before you add your oil, so that it tempers them a little bit. It makes them a little less sharp. And then you have a base. And so what I'll do is do a very simple vinaigrette with maybe the vinegar, either shallot or garlic, and the oil, a little salt and pepper, maybe a dollop of mustard. If I want it to sweeten it a little bit, I'll add a little maple sugar or maybe just a little bit of honey. Mm-hmm. Shake it up, and then you can just keep that on the counter. And then add your fresh herbs just for the amount you're going to use. Because if you add the herbs and let them sit around, they get kind of slimy.
Yeah.
So you're going to want to add the fresh herbs and maybe, you know, shake the dressing up, pour it into another container, add your fresh herbs to that new container, shake that up, and then that's your salad dressing for that particular dish. But then you have in reserve, you know, the base for any vinaigrette ready to go. And with that, when you have a base like that, you can play with it. You can pour a little bit into a dish and maybe add some whole milk yogurt or some buttermilk or whisk in a little mayonnaise if you want a creamy dressing. You can sweeten it a little bit if you want to pour some off and add a little more honey or maple syrup to make and maybe a little more mustard to make like a honey mustard vinaigrette, that kind of thing. So you have a big base, and then you can play with it, pouring off small amounts as you go, depending on what it is you're going to dress.
Well, let's go to Nancy now in Verona. Hi, Nancy. I understand you made a blueberry pie.
Yum.
yes, I've had one of our favorite pies here is what we call blue barb pie.
It's yum.
And blueberries together. And blueberries cut a lot of the tart of the rhubarb for some reason.
Yes.
And it's just 3 cups chopped rhubarb, 3 pints of blueberries, and cornstarch to thicken it, usually about 3 rounded tablespoons.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you find it's too tart, you can add some sugar, but we heat it and then serve it with ice cream so it doesn't get oversweet. And it's really, really good.
That sounds absolutely delicious. And I can tell you that's the kind of pie I might have for breakfast. sounds
yeah.
really good without the ice cream. Maybe just a... Yeah?
Yeah, that's what I feel like. It's not any different than having a blueberry-filled donut for breakfast. You know?
Yeah, and it's better for you because you're not using any sugar. So it's really, you know, if you're not using any sugar and you're sweetening the rhubarb with the natural sweetness of the blueberries, what a great idea.
Well, Nancy, you did say pie. What do you do for the crust?
Oh, I'm old-fashioned. I go to the grocery store and buy Pillsbury's pie crust.
I love that. That's a pretty good crust. Good for you.
Yeah, mine never turned out, so I just gave up and... Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
I just wanted to bring that up. All
and
right.
Nancy, do you, just quickly here, do you have a top on your pie, or do you just have it exposed?
I have a top on it.
Okay, yeah.
Boy, that sounds good.
It does. It's very good. But anyway, have a good day.
You too, Nancy.
Thanks for
calling. We have Minneapolis-based chef and cookbook author Beth Dooley who stays with us. You can join in. Are you planning to bring a fresh homemade dish to a barbecue? Are you looking for suggestions? So we were talking about, I recently had a strawberry rhubarb crisp courtesy of my mother-in-law's kitchen. It was absolutely out of this world. And it's really nice to have that rhubarb in season now. Still time to talk about what you're cooking, what's coming in your CSA box. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Beth Dooley on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent with Beth Dooley. She's the author or co-author of more than a dozen cookbooks over the decades. Her new one expands on what is local food. She incorporates regenerative agriculture with recipes featuring artisan grains. We've been talking about nuts, fruits, veggies that help the soil sequester carbon. It's called The Perennial Kitchen, and Beth Dooley is with us for 10 more minutes. We heard from Cole in Kenosha is listening, wrote an email and says, Beth, I'm fairly new to cooking, don't feel confident enough to cook without a recipe. And Cole asks, do I just need more experience or are there certain books that will help me be able to pair flavors without following a recipe?
You know, that's a great question, Cole. Thank you. And if you'll forgive my shameless self-promotion, my son, Kip, who lives in D.C., who also is a beginning cook, and I started a blog called Bare Bones Cooking. You can find the link on my website. And I answer a lot of those questions because the idea is getting back to basics. I think the COVID really drove us all back to our kitchens and made us kind of question what's important in cooking. You know, what are the fundamentals? What do we really need to know to be able to improvise so that we can be more confident when we step up and go, oh, you know, I don't have time to run to the store, but here's what I have in my cupboard. Here's what I have in my fridge. What can I make? And so that's the premise of that blog. And then we're also doing live a series of cooking classes that's available through Bare Bones. It's a 6-week course. And we walk through a lot of those basic techniques and make really fun, easy meals together. And once you get those basic techniques and fundamentals down, you're like a jazz musician. You can just go ahead and improvise. So that's the idea behind it. Thank you for asking.
I saw the video where Kip's like, Mom, I have 2 potatoes. What do I do with these 2 potatoes? And I'm like, oh my gosh, what is she going to do with these?
Exactly. Yeah. And it's so much fun. And it's, you know, that's one of the beauties too of these Zoom classes is that you don't have to go anyplace. You know, you just turn your computer on, you make dinner together.
Oh, that's so fabulous. Well, yeah. Terry from DeForest shared over email, our family has Southern roots. My mother used to make cornmeal mush. It would set up in a loaf pan. Then she'd fry it and dress it with butter and maple syrup. Is polenta just an updated word for cornmeal mush?
Thank you for asking. And yes, it is. You're exactly right. There are two different grinds of cornmeal. What is called the polenta grind is a little rougher, but I love it for cornmeal mush. And basically you're frying up polenta, and you can do that for breakfast. It's delicious. I love the idea of frying up the cornmeal mush or polenta for breakfast and putting maple syrup on it. It's also wonderful fried up the same way and then drizzled with maybe a little hazelnut oil and some chopped herbs and chopped tomatoes and a little fresh mozzarella cheese. And you have really just a fried polenta, which is very popular. You pay $1 million for it in a fancy restaurant, but you can do that at home. So thank you for bringing that up, because again, I think people think, oh, I can only use mush for this or, you know, polenta for that. But in fact, they're interchangeable and you can go both savory and sweet. And I would also add that there are a couple of farms now growing and pressing sorghum syrup, which if you're Southern, you may be familiar with that as well. And that's fabulous on cornmeal mush for breakfast or fried polenta for breakfast, whatever you want to call it. It's still good.
And you also do the fried egg with your polenta with your recipe. What is your approach to a fried egg when you know, we're getting back to basics here.
We're getting back to basics here. Okay, here's what I do. Okay. I want it to be fully cooked, but I don't want it to be hard. So what I usually do is, you know, you get some butter going in the pan low. You don't want to have it too high because then the proteins in that egg white are going to harden up. So you want to keep the butter and the heat relatively low. You crack the egg into the pan, into that sort of bubbling butter. You need enough butter, of course. And then you let the white, you can watch the white. You need to pay attention. You watch the white and see it get firm. And then if you want the top to cook a little bit, put a lid on it for about 2 or 3 seconds. If you have a glass lid, that's going to help you keep an eye on it because you can see through to both the white and the yolk. And then when it looks like it's firm enough to your liking and the white is completely white, not that sort of clear, you know it's done. And then you just slide it off onto a piece of toast or onto your polenta and you're good to go.
We're talking with cookbook author Beth Dooley as we cook with fresh ingredients, talking about supporting local farms and regenerative agriculture. You can join in with your recipes, your questions about cooking, 800-642-1234. Beth, we haven't touched on currants and elderberries and maybe some other berries that would be really nutritious and we could cook with this time of year. What would you suggest?
That's a great question because I love all of those berries and I wish that we had more people growing currants because I know I can find fresh currants at the farmer's market and I'm growing a bunch of them in my yard now. The birds love them and they're very, very tart. You don't want to eat them without cooking them first with another fruit to sweeten them or with a little bit of sugar or honey or maple syrup, but they're so good for you. They're just loaded in antioxidants. The same thing with elderberries, which there have been studies now that show all of the antioxidant properties in elderberries, for instance, and in Europe, they're doing studies on elderberries to show that they actually boost brain function. And so they're using them for people that have memory issues, which like me, hello, and they're pressed, in that case, those elderberries are cooked, and then they're pressed into syrup that's sweetened and used as a tonic. So it can be cut with spring water, for instance, or with just water mixed with another juice. It's really, really good. And I use elderberries sometimes the way I would rhubarb. It's tartar than rhubarb. You don't want to eat them fresh. They're very tannic. But you can throw fresh elderberries in with, say, any fruit, raspberries or apples. They make a wonderful apple pie if you throw them in with apples, maybe a quarter of a cup of elderberries, right? And they turn the fruit a beautiful sort of purple color. So you get an apple pie that's got this really pretty sort of violet color and then the apples and it's tart sweet. They're really good and they're so nutritious. You can buy elderberries both fresh and frozen and dried from the Midwest Elderberry Cooperative. And you can also find a number of elderberry juices and different elderberry products in most local co-ops. So it's just a wonderful, wonderful plant that also, again, has all of these environmental properties to it that just do so much for the land as well as for our health.
Well, going back to the environment for the last moments we have, I mean, you've made so many relationships over the years with farmers, and I'm just wondering, what have farmers taught you about food?
That's a great question. They've taught me to pay attention. I think what I've really learned is how hard this work is and how much respect I have for people that are willing to do this work and do it with integrity, and that the really good farmers are in it for the long haul. They're making a commitment to the future, to not only our lives and to our food right now, but to the future of our food and to doing the best they can to ensure that there will be food for all of us later on and food for our children in years to come. And there's an old trope that a good farmer doesn't plant for today. He does the work, he or she, there's so many women farming now, they do the work to, they do work that they may not see the results of in the future. And to me, that's a guiding principle that I think we've lost in many of our businesses. We're all in for the short run. We're all in for the short return. And that's one of the values that I keep in the back of my mind whenever I work with any of these ingredients. How much work, how much time, how much commitment went into growing these foods, and that they are really valuable and that we need to appreciate them and honor them. So that's kind of, you know, where I come from on this.
Beth, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kate. This was so much fun. Thank you. And please, listeners, stay in touch. My website's got my email on it. If you have more questions, I'd love to hear from you.
Beth Dooley, author, co-author of a bunch of cookbooks, her latest, The Perennial Kitchen, Simple Recipes for a Healthy Future on the Ideas Network.